Hello, I'm Evan Ratliff, editor-in-chief of the Atavist Magazine. You're listening to the Atavist Magazine podcast. This is The Ghosts of Pickering Trail, episode 3 of 3. As always, if you have not listened to the first two episodes, we recommend that you do. But just to recap, in the first two episodes, we found out about Janet Milliken and her two children who moved into a new house in Thornton, Pennsylvania in 2007. Soon after, they found out that the previous occupants had died in a murder-suicide, and they sued the seller of the home to rescind the sale. Meanwhile, the family had experienced things that they could not explain. Objects moving on their own, doors swinging open, footsteps on the stairs, being awoken by the sensation of someone's presence only to find an empty room. Their lawsuit wound its way through the court system, and in the summer of 2010, Janet's lawyer filed their final appeal. And now here's Will Hunt and Matt Wolf with the final episode of The Ghosts of Pickering Trail. This is Matt.
Courts have been grappling with the legal ambiguities of stigmatized real estate since the 1980s. One of the earliest cases involving haunted property was brought in New York in 1989 by a bond trader named Jeffrey Stambofsky. Shortly after he placed a deposit on an 18-room Victorian mansion in Nyack, Stambofsky learned that his new house was reputed to be possessed by poltergeists. Its seller, Helen Ackley, had, in fact, actively publicized the haunting for years and even offered walking tours of the property and published articles about her three spectral tenants, a young girl, a Revolutionary War-era naval lieutenant, and an apple-cheeked old man whom Ackley once watched steal and eat an entire ham sandwich. "Our ghosts have continued to delight us," she told Reader's Digest in 1977, calling them gracious, thoughtful, only occasionally frightening, and thoroughly entertaining. Stambofsky and his wife, uncomfortable with the house's reputation, declared themselves victims of an ectoplasmic fraud and sued to rescind the sale. A lower court initially sided with Ackley, applying the rule of caveat emptor, buyer beware. An appellate court, though, disagreed. In a pun-filled decision, the presiding judge stated that he was moved by the spirit of equity to rule in favor of Stambofsky, arguing that there was no way for the buyer to know that the house was haunted, as experts in paranormal phenomena were rare. Who, the justice wrote, you gonna call? Moreover, the judge argued, Ackley had advertised that the house had ghosts, so she couldn't deny this fact later. Thus, he concluded, as a matter of law, the house is haunted. Because Ackley failed to disclose the haunting, the court ruled in Stambofsky's favor and ordered the sale rescinded. 25 years later, statutes regarding the sale of haunted houses are still relatively rare. Real estate law is made at the state level, and very few state courts have set hard and fast rules regarding a property's history. Of those that have, only a handful require a seller to disclose a death. Milliken v. Jacona would offer the first major court decision regarding stigmatized property in 25 years. The decision could ultimately affect the disclosure rules for millions of properties in Pennsylvania, and likely influence future rulings in other state courts. Milliken v. Jacona was an exceptional case, not least because the court was being asked to perform a task more suited to a seminary, to weigh our relationship to the dead. That a place can be affected by the abiding presence of the deceased, which is to say haunted, is one of humanity's most universal ideas. From the ancient Assyrians to Australian Aborigines, people have long believed that bodies decompose, but spirits linger on. In much of the world, the existence of specters, poltergeists, and ancestral phantoms remains a fact of daily life, as self-evident as the ground underfoot. In the modern West, our philosophy is inconsistent. Rationalism leaves little room for ghosts. To sense their presence in a place is to tread into dubious, unscientific territory. And yet, the latent dead continued to command reverence. No one would dare claim that Gettysburg is just a field in Pennsylvania, that Treblinka is just a forest in Poland. As the court examined the evidence, it was forced to interrogate these cultural incongruities, to conduct a rational assessment of irrational faiths. In the Pennsylvania legal system, the legacy of ghosts was to be measured with the most unsentimental of yardsticks, the price paid in the free market. Finding that psychological stigma tangibly affected the value of a property would mean that our relationship to the remembered dead had to be taken seriously. It would mean that ghosts, considered in these terms, were real. In the spring of 2011, the Delaware County Court of Common Pleas gathered to review the evidence submitted by the parties in Milliken v. Jacono. The two sides had been trading motions and arguments for several years. The central facts of the case, though, were not in dispute. Both parties acknowledged that the Jaconos had known about the Kumbulis' deaths before the sale and declined to share this information with Milliken. The disagreement, then, was whether the Jaconos had been legally obligated to do so. Joseph Jacono claimed in his deposition that he, like Milliken, had not known about the murder when he purchased the house. Despite living just a few hundred yards away, on the other side of a thin grove of trees, Jacono said he was not aware of the tragedy. According to Jacono, in September 2006, he was driving through his neighborhood when he saw a sign advertising an estate sale. He ended up at 12 Pickering Trail, where he found an auction in progress, in which the house's contents were being sold off, lot by lot. Furnishings, clothing, a TV, even the car. The last thing auctioned off that day was the house itself. Jacono, an industrial contractor, had long thought about buying a property, fixing it up, and flipping it. When Jacono asked one of the attendees at the auction why the house was being sold, the person said the previous owner had committed suicide. Jacono claimed in the deposition that the attendee had mentioned only a suicide, not a murder, though he could not recall when or how he eventually learned about Georgia Kumbulis' death. After a short visual inspection of the premises, Jacono entered the minimum bid of $450,000 and, being the only bidder, won. However, unlike Milliken, Jacono said that the house didn't seem stigmatized. When he did find out about the murder-suicide, he stated, it did not bother him. At one point, he even considered giving the property to his daughter, who was soon to be married. She did not move in, explained Jacono, because he ended up spending too much on renovations. Though the house sold for $160,000 more than Jacono had paid for it, factoring in renovations, interest, and fees, Jacono stated that his profit was only about $40,000. Jacono made a good-faith effort to ensure that he was not breaking the law when he advertised the property. Before listing the house, he consulted with the Pennsylvania Real Estate Commission, which, echoing his broker, told him that disclosure of the death was legally unnecessary, as a murder in the house was not considered a material defect. Yet Jacono specifically instructed his broker not to tell buyers about the house's past unless asked, an inconsistency that Milliken's attorney, Timothy Rain, emphasized in his arguments. However Jacono might feel about the murder-suicide, Rain pointed out, he made a deliberate choice, knowing that a stigmatized property is inherently less valuable than an unstigmatized one. In Jacono's version of events, he did not believe he was receiving a stigma discount when he bought the house. He thought it was cheap only because it was in bad shape. To support his claims, Rain submitted Randall Bell's report, which laid out how the memory of the deaths had tangibly hurt Milliken's property value. The report represented a summation of Bell's life's work. It assessed the Milliken house alongside 10 case studies based on Bell's own appraisals of properties where violent crimes had been committed, including the Nicole Brown Simpson condominium, the Benedict Canyon house where Sharon Tate was murdered, and the mansion where Lyle and Eric Menendez shot their parents. Bell's argument was simple. Stigma had caused each of these properties to lose value for many years. The passing of time may help restore some of the value, but this can take many years, even decades. The real estate community, he wrote, often termed these brake light properties, as they often see the brake lights of the prospective buyer's car driving away after disclosing the property's history. He pointed to the 10-15% depreciation he'd estimated on Milliken's home. This financial loss was specific and measurable, Bell argued. It was the very definition of a material defect. To punch holes in Bell's report, the Jaconos' counsel enlisted another attorney, Stanley Lieberman. Lieberman, who had nearly 50 years' experience as a real estate attorney and 35 as a broker, argued that Bell's report was irrelevant. Lieberman was unimpressed by Bell's methodology, calling his estimate of the percentage by which death depreciates a property blatant speculation. Moreover, the examples included in the report, Lieberman contended, were inappropriate for comparison. Only one of them, a house where a woman had handcuffed and shot her husband, was a suburban house, and it had not yet sold, so it could hardly serve as a measure of lost value. The rest, he pointed out, were businesses, schools, and government buildings. Bell's theories on the power of stigma, therefore, did not apply to the Millikan property. The Court of Common Pleas was not moved by Bell's argument either. On August 9, 2010, the court unanimously ruled in favor of the Jaconos. In his opinion, Judge George Pagano provided a list of 16 physical attributes of a house that must be provided by sellers of real estate in Pennsylvania, including roof, 3, termites, wood-destroying insects, 5, and soils and drainage, 13. Psychological stigma simply did not apply. When Millikan received word on the ruling, she was despondent. It seemed she would never escape her house. However, for the sake of her children, Millikan persisted. She filed an appeal which landed before the 9 judges of the Superior Court of Pennsylvania. On the day after Christmas 2012, the court came down with a split decision in favor of the Jaconos. The majority opinion came from President Judge Emeritus Kate Ford Elliott. The fact that a murder once occurred in a house, she wrote, falls into that category of homebuyer concerns best left to caveat emptor. How recent must the murder be that the seller must inform the buyer? What if the murder happened 100 years ago? What if numerous owners had lived in the house in the interim? How can a monetary value possibly be assigned to the psychological damage to a house caused by a murder? The psychological effect will vary greatly from person to person. There are persons for whom no amount of money would induce them to live in such a house, while others may not care at all, or even find it adventurous. To call psychological stigma material, she went on, would require the seller to warn not only of the physically quantifiable, but also of utterly subjective defects. Judge John Bender, along with 2 other justices, filed the dissenting opinion. Bender wrote powerfully in Millikan's defense. Evoking the horror of her discovering the Cumbulus incident, he quoted Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice. Truth will come to light. Murder cannot be long hid. He condemned the Jaconos. The financial penalty Mrs. Millikan has suffered was entirely avoidable had the sellers from whom she bought her house merely exercised a little more integrity and a little less greed. Citing Bell's report, he argued that the damage did indeed constitute a material defect. Whereas the majority would consign the stigma of murder/suicide to the ethereal realm of psychological damage, the statute recognizes it for what it is, documented economic loss. Bender cited a case from California, Reed v. King, which closely resembled Millikan v. Jaconos. In 1983, Doris Reed sued to rescind the sale of her home when she discovered that it had been the site of a mass murder 10 years earlier. A lower court initially ruled against her, but a higher court ruled that Reed had the right to rescind the sale if she could prove, to another court, that the murder negatively affected the value of the house. However, before Reed could do so, the 2 sides settled, and the issue went undecided. Several years later, the California legislature ruled that sellers had to disclose any death that had occurred on the premises within the previous 3 years. Millikan herself had complied with the statute when she sold her home. When Millikan received word from Rain of the court's decision, she was disappointed but also heartened. Bender's dissent had given her hope. Even though she'd lost again, she felt closer to escaping 12 Pickering Trail. She consulted with Rain and decided to file another final appeal on the same basis as the first, a misreading of the term material defect. A new set of judges, she hoped, would understand her plight.
On November 19, 2013, the lawyers from both sides presented arguments before the Pennsylvania Supreme Court in Harrisburg. Timothy Rain, an earnest man in a red bow tie, spoke first. "What happened in the house was extreme," he said. "A reasonable buyer, not this buyer, not a subjective buyer, but a reasonable buyer, would consider that to be material." The judges took turns peppering Rain with questions about the varieties of stigma. There were, the justices pointed out, an infinite number of hypothetical situations which may make a person uncomfortable. "What if, for example, someone died of AIDS in the house?" asked Judge Max Baer. "Or a gay couple lived nearby and a member of the Tea Party objected to that? What if a child was abused in it?" asked Coriale Stevens. "Or an animal murdered? There are lots of things in a buyer's mind that might ultimately affect his happiness in the house or even the value," Justice Deborah McCloskey-Todd said, "but but that doesn't mean it's a material defect that entitles them to legal recovery. What test, the judges wanted to know, determines whether stigma rises to the level of defect? Are all stigmas defects? Justice Michael Eakin asked. You have to draw the line somewhere, Rain said. A stigma became a defect, he said, when it began to affect the property value. In the case of Milliken, he said, Randall Bell's report proved that stigma had a deleterious impact on the price of the house. The judges seemed skeptical, but also curious about the implications. Justice Seamus McCaffrey noted that they were arguing the case on the 150th anniversary of Abraham Lincoln's speech at Gettysburg. What if Lincoln had stayed overnight at a farmhouse nearby after the address? A seller would surely note that. If a seller is going to disclose the good, he offered, shouldn't they be required to disclose the bad, too? That's my argument exactly, Rain said. To pretend that psychological things don't affect value is not reality. When Rain had finished, Abraham Reich, a silver-haired man in a black pinstripe suit, rose to argue on behalf of the Jaconos. He urged the court to revisit the language of the disclosure laws. The Jaconos, he said, had complied with every statute. There's no duty for the seller to disclose this kind of defect, he said. Justice Eakin appeared down at Reich. Is there to be a laundry list of things, stigma things, that now a buyer must ask? He asked. If something is material to a buyer, they should raise it, Reich replied. Eakin shook his head. There are some things that are so fundamental, like a mass murder, Eakin said. I shouldn't have to ask to be told. On July 21st, 2014, 6 years after Milliken first filed suit, the 7 justices of the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania issued their decision. Justice Eakin wrote the opinion. It was, legally speaking, a curious document. It is safe to assume, he wrote, that murders, suicides, and other tragedies are events a majority of the population would find disturbing, and a certain percentage of the population may not want to live in a house where any such event has occurred. But ultimately, the varieties of traumatizing events that could occur on a property are endless. Efforts to define those that would warrant mandatory disclosure would be a Sisyphean task. Does a bloodless death by poisoning or overdose create a less significant defect than a bloody one from a stabbing or shooting? How would one treat other violent crimes, such as rape, assault, home invasion, or child abuse? What if the killings were elsewhere, but the sadistic killer lived there? What if satanic rituals were performed in the house? In effect, Eakin acknowledged that the dead leave a lasting effect on certain spaces, one that persists long after they're gone. At the same time, the court disagreed with Randall Bell's assertion that stigma could be easily identified and evaluated. In the end, psychological stigma is too capricious and strange to measure, too messily human to plot on a chart. It was, at least, beyond the ken of the court, to confront head-on the way our memories, like ghosts, linger in a place, would lead down a slippery slope, a slope we are not willing to descend. Regardless of the potential impact a psychological stigma may have on the value of property, Eakin concluded, we are not ready to accept that such constitutes a material defect. The justices ruled in favor of the Jaconos. When Randall Bell heard about the ruling, he was disappointed. He thought that the justices had been unwilling to tackle the implications of psychological stigma. They're in over their heads intellectually, he said. They didn't take on the issue. But the Milliken ruling didn't affect his steady stream of work. His office phone in Laguna Beach continued to ring, people from all over the world summoning him to places where the residue of tragedy was still palpable. When the ruling came down, he had just returned from Newtown, Connecticut, where he had consulted on the house in which 20-year-old Adam Lanza had shot his mother in her bed before walking to Sandy Hook Elementary and murdering 20 children and 6 adults. Standing in Lanza's basement bedroom, among his toys and posters and video games, Bell felt sick to his stomach. That's a place where very evil thinking was born, he said. You wouldn't have a pulse if you didn't sense the sadness. Bell had met with community leaders, and they decided to raise the structure and let Woodlands take over the lot. The loss was devastating to Milliken. after 6 long years, she and her family would not be able to leave. Nothing had changed, per se, and yet something seemed different. On a recent Saturday afternoon, the Milliken family gathered in the kitchen of 12 Pickering Trail. Kendra, 20, was home visiting from college. She was still in her sweatpants and was waking up from a nap on the couch after a night out with friends. Ryan carried a ladder from the garage to the kitchen. He lived with his girlfriend in an apartment nearby and had dropped by to paint the front hall for his mother. Milliken sat at the table, sipping a cup of coffee. Their two dogs, Roscoe, a Yorkie, and Baby, a pit bull, tumbled back and forth in the kitchen. Milliken had slowly come to realize that in fits and starts, her family had begun to heal. Even as the lawsuit wound its way through the courts, the kids had stopped avoiding the house. Kendra had even hosted a sleepover there for a birthday. With time, the family had re-entered the world. Kendra was a junior at the nearby University of Delaware, where she majored in communications and became president of the ballroom dance team. Ryan was planning to study to be an electrician and a general contractor. Milliken was working full-time as the financial manager of a local nursing home. Strange disturbances in the house were a thing of the past. When Milliken looked back on the preceding years, she realized that the move from California had been a mistake, and not just because of her unfortunate selection of a house. She'd failed to give her family and herself the time and space to grieve. Life wasn't perfect. 12 Pickering Trail would never feel like the house back in California, full of people and activity and Frank's happy energy. Milliken still saw her husband in her dreams, but they were through it. The kids were talking about going into real estate together. "The kind of thing where we get in and buy foreclosed houses," said Ryan. Kendra would sell the houses after Ryan, who was apprenticing with a local contractor, fixed them up. And yet, from time to time, Milliken would still feel the old chill. Not long after, Milliken replaced the carpet in the master bedroom. After the workers pulled up the old carpet, she went upstairs to look at the bare floor. In the middle of it, she noticed a patch of white paint. Maybe it had been applied to cover one of the bloodstains from the Kumbulis incident, she thought. But then her memory went back to the day that she had knelt at the foot of her bed and, gripping her rosary, asked the bad energy to leave her family alone. The patch, she thought, was exactly where she'd knelt.
Thank you for listening to the final episode of The Ghosts of Pickering Trail by Will Hunt and Matt Wolf. Check out this and other stories on the web at magazine.atavist.com. We have over 50 narrative stories. We put out one every single month. You can also subscribe in iTunes, Stitcher, or your listening app of choice to catch the next story on the Atavist Magazine podcast. This podcast was edited by Megan Dietry. The story was edited by Katya Bachko and fact-checked by Aviva Stahl. I'm Evan Ratliff, the editor-in-chief of the Atavist Magazine. Thank you for listening.